Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Cold-Blooded, Part 2. Robert Balding was an auxiliary fireman at Knowles Green Fire Station, just outside of the town of Staines, and 16 and a half miles southwest of Chiswick. Far from the fiery brunt of the Luftwaffe's Blitz, this little village sometimes got a crashed fighter, a downed bomber, or a lost V-1 rocket exploding in their fields. But mostly, they saw car crashes, stuck cats, and chip pan fires. But very rarely, a murder. Having finished a 48-hour shift, on Saturday the 7th of October at 9:10 a.m, Robert took a shortcut and strolled down a dirt track at the rear of Stainash Crescent. With the wind blowing a gale and the ground boggy and wet, he was too tired to realise what he was seeing when his eyes spied a bundle of rags in a ditch. The ditch was wide and shallow, he recalled. I saw it was a man who I thought was sleeping. Only who would sleep face down in the mud on a cold night like this? When I went to him, it struck me that with his feet higher than his head, that he must be ill. I shook his shoulder, only he did not move, groan, or murmur. And with his dark blue overcoat pulled right up over his eyes and his head, as I lifted the lapel, I saw from the colour of his face, which was blue and grey, that he was dead. Robert called the police, and with the body being someone who was loved, the people who missed him were already worried. Having failed to pick her up at 8 a.m. as planned, his girlfriend Violet called his pal Arthur Green at Godfrey Davies, who hadn't seen him since 11:05 p.m. and she reported him missing. And with Harry Hawkins, the owner of the Ford V8, expecting him back at 9 a.m, knowing him to be honest and punctual, he gave the police the car's description, the license plate, and the driver's name. Only the missing man, the stolen car, and the dumped body were yet to be connected. Divisional Detective Inspector Tansel arrived at 9:45 a.m. The ditch was an odd spot to dump a body, as being 440 yards from the road, this 11-foot-wide, 3-foot-deep ditch was 22 feet from the dirt track, so it wasn't the kind of place you could just stumble upon. With the corpse in a state of rigor mortis, having been dead for between 4 to 10 hours, there were no signs of violence, struggle, or defensive wounds. Lying face down, with his limbs crossed and his once neat clothes all muddy and rocked up, it was clear that someone had dragged him to the ditch. and with his jacket unbuttoned, as a very possible robbery. Anything of value had been stolen, with his killer leaving all the crap. Two hankies, a broken comb, a latchkey, 5 cigarettes, a cinema ticket, a pocket knife, a rubber, and a vial of 3 pills. Which also meant that the police couldn't identify him. They had no idea who he was, why he was killed, or who by. But they knew he hadn't died here. An autopsy confirmed that the body had been dumped within 2 hours of his death, and that a single .45 caliber bullet had nicked the underside of his rear 6th rib, exited via the 3rd front rib, and had perforated both lobes of his right lung and his spinal cord, leaving him paralyzed and drowning in his own blood. With the blood on his palm matching the exit wound to his chest, Robert Churchill, a gun expert for the Met Police, confirmed that although there was no scorching found on his back, the shot was fired at a close range, as with the exit wound being keyhole-shaped. This indicated that the bullet had turned sideways, meaning it had been fired from a minimum of 9 inches. And with a concentrated pattern of blood spatter on both of his legs, this suggested that the victim was in a seated position when he was shot. So was this a carjacking, a robbery, or an execution? The killer had been careful to leave nothing behind, with no ID, no blood, no prints, and no bullets. And yet, the car itself could not say the same. On the dirt road, DDI Tansel spotted 2 parallel tire marks, exactly 4 feet and 10 inches apart, veering in a sharp-handed curve off the road and onto the grass by the ditch, with the tread leaving distinct grooves and small tufts of grass which had been cut away and were soaked in oil. During house-to-house inquiries, Reginald Turney of 68 Stainash Crescent stated, "I was awoken at 3 a.m. or thereabouts by the sound of a car's engine revving hard as if it was being driven on bumpy ground." He only heard these sounds, but by the ditch, between the tire grooves and the cut grass bumps, the detective found the handbrake return spring of an almost new car, which Ralph Blackburn, a specialist at the Ford Motor Company in Dagenham, would confirm it belonged to a Ford V8 saloon. At the crime scene, the killer had been cautious not to leave any clues. And yet, through cold-blooded arrogance, he had tossed the victim's possessions that he didn't want out of the car's back window, which led a kind boy doing a good deed for a total stranger to stumble upon vital evidence before the body was even found. At 8 a.m, John Anthony Jones, an electrician's apprentice, was passing the Great West Road near Kane's Lane when he spotted a brown leather wallet on a grass verge. Handing it to the police, inside was the driving license, the checkbook, and the ID of 34-year-old George Edward Heath, a man who had been reported missing in a possible stolen car whose description matched the body in the ditch. Identified by his wife Winifred, with the police having circulated the details of a grey Ford V8 saloon, registration plate RD8955. Within 36 hours, the police had identified the man, the car, and a possible motive. What they needed was to find his cold-blooded killer before he killed again. Second Lieutenant Richard Allen, of the 101st Airborne of the US Army, was the name he gave. Based in Reading, he went by the name of Ricky. Only this wasn't Ricky, and the uniform was stolen. As a thick-set brute, like an archetypal gangster, with dark swept-back hair like a mafia hitman, and cold dead eyes like he was devoid of any emotion. 22-year-old Private Carl Gustav Holton wanted to be someone. He wanted to be big, feared, respected, and he didn't care who he had to step on to get it. Born to Swedish parents in Stockholm on the 3rd of March 1922, they entered America in 1923 when he was only 1 year old. But with his father being a man with a notoriously violent temper who beat him black and blue. Although he could have had his mother's kindness, instead he mirrored this monster. Educated at the Farm and Trade School in Boston, Carl was not best blessed with brains, being a sturdy man of brawn with slow wits and quick fists. And although, as a married man with a daughter, he had tried to hold down a job as a clerk, a mechanic, a lorry driver, and a skating instructor, being a moody, short-fused brute, he resented authority, especially when he was inducted into the US Army in 1943. Shipped to the UK in January 1944 as a truck driver for the 501st Infantry. Although none of the soldiers knew it, he was due to take part in the bloody invasion of Normandy, codenamed Operation Overlord, on the 6th of June 1944. But burdened by a fiery temper and a criminal bent, he never did. As a selfish, arrogant man who was unfaithful to his wife and unfaithful to his girlfriend, in the weeks following the invasion, when his comrades were giving their lives and soaking foreign shores with their own blood, this sticky-fingered thief, brutal lump, and gutless traitor only ever thought about himself and his needs. On the 14th of July 1944, Private Carl Holton absconded from his barracks and going AWOL for almost a month. He was arrested, fined $20, and imprisoned for 20 days for carrying a concealed weapon. One day before his court-martial, he again went AWOL. Only with no intention to ever return, he went on a spree of thievery. He stole the uniform of Second Lieutenant Richard Allen, another off Private Werner J. Meyer, which he stashed in a US Army B-4 bag in the cloakroom of Hammersmith Tube Station. He also stole a six-wheeled, 2.5-ton US Army truck from the 101st Airborne, as well as a Colt Remington automatic pistol stolen from Staff Sergeant Sherman, which being loaded with 7 rounds of 45 caliber bullets, which was a gun he would use to kill a cabbie in cold blood, who he hadn't met until 15 minutes before the murder. Carl Holton dreamed of being a gangster. But what he wanted most was a girl who would adore him. Tuesday the 3rd of October, Paul's Cafe, 1 Queen Caroline Street in Hammersmith. A greasy spoon, which was thick with cigarette plumes, heart-clogging fry-ups, and the steam of a bubbling tea urn. Amongst a sea of soldiers, civvies and cabbies, Len Bexley sat chatting to his daughter's friend when Carl came in.
Ricky Allen, meet Georgina Grayson, Len said,
introducing the sour-faced hulking brute to to the slim-faced 18-year-old with brown-curled hair, pale skin, and red lips. Quickly smitten, like him, she couldn't let on that her name was an alias. And although he used his to avoid arrest, hers was to mask the shame that this part-time dancer and wannabe actress was actually just plain old Elizabeth Jones, also known as Betty, who was an out-of-work waitress from the mining town of Neath in South Wales. Fresh to the big city, sweet little Georgie sought a life of excitement. And here, she found Ricky. Ricky was unlike any man she had ever met. A bad boy without a care in the world, and a dark brooding menace who did whatever he liked. And as they chatted, he coolly told her of his crimes. Ricky told me of several jobs he'd done, she said. He'd broken into the Hope and got 50 quid. Wednesday last, he did a jeweller's and a gown shop in King Street. A cafe in Shepherd's Bush, a greengrocer's and a pawn shop. He'd broken into several pubs in Reading, and he'd shot an American soldier. I think he'd said he'd drowned him. He also said he'd killed a man and a woman with a gun in the West End. Staring into his soulless eyes, as this callous killer spoke so casually about murder, given that the worst thing she had ever done was to run away from home, she should have fled, but she didn't. Her heart was racing, her eyes were wide, and her mouth was dry. But the brute didn't frighten her. He excited her. 10:30 p.m. He picked her up in a six-wheeled, 2.5-ton U.S. Army truck, which he bragged,
"I stole from Reading a few days ago."
Being hot, the truck was probably being hunted. And although her instincts should have been to get out, run, and don't look back, as an immature little girl who was raised on a diet of American gangster movies and not reality, she was drawn to his thrills and his danger. In truth, he could have been a bullshitter. But in the truck, he pulled out a loaded pistol. The gun he would later use to kill a lone cabbie in cold blood. And although she'd state,
"He said he'd killed several people in Chicago with a gun."
Again, she didn't scream and she didn't flee. She shared a dream which would seal her fate. "I'd love to do something exciting," she said. "Something dangerous, like being a gun mole." And there the deal was done. Ricky would get his girl, and Georgie would get her gangster. That night, they drove, heading west and prowling the unlit country lanes on the outskirts of Reading. Having driven through the town and found nothing of interest, Georgie said, "We started back towards London at about 2 a.m. When we got on the road back, near Maidenhead, on the London to Bath Road, we passed a girl. She was a lone lady on a bicycle, heading home after a long shift at work. We drove on for about 5 minutes and pulled up at the side of the road. It was dark, isolated, with hedgerows on either side, and the only light to be seen was the faint light of her bicycle's headlamp. He got out and waited for the girl to come along. Looking like a parked up truck, with no one inside, the girl would have seen nothing and sensed no danger as she passed by. but as the brute sprang from the shadows. As the girl came alongside, I saw him push her. She fell, and she screamed, "Don't touch me."
Cut, bruised, and shaken. As she stumbled to her feet, with Ricky picking up her purse as one of the prizes he would wantonly take. Gripped by fear, the girl didn't need to think twice as she fled for her life. And as she ran down the middle of a dark country lane, as fast as her legs could carry her, having been taught how to drive a truck by Ricky, he barked, "Get after her," as Georgie floored the engine. Behind the girl, the engine revved, and with its dim yellow lights illuminating her panicked frame as it darted back and forth like a frightened rabbit. With the girl having nowhere to run, all she would have heard was the engine getting ever nearer and closer, never knowing what her fate may be. Maybe crushed under the wheels, maybe kidnapped and held for ransom, or maybe raped, tortured, and murdered. From the right-hand passenger seat, Ricky spotted her, saying,
"She's there, she's there."
As his torch shined on the whites of her petrified eyes, as she crouched in the shrubbery. But being in the garden of a cottage, as the blacko blinds moved and a light shined upon her, the truck quickly sped on, and the girl was safe. It was a lucky escape for her, but only just. Back at Hammersmith, we parked the truck in the old Gorman Cinema car park in Sussex Place and went back to my room, and Ricky stayed the night. Excited by the thrill of the chase, they had sex. But the contents of the young girl's handbag wasn't much of a score for this gangster and his gun mole. Having nicked a book, 6 shillings, some clothing coupons, a flannel, some soap, and a sanitary towel. The next morning, Georgie introduced the landlady to her new boyfriend. But being a good judge of character, she said, "I thought there was something fishy about him." Georgie said she was going to meet him again that night at midnight. I told her she must be mad, that she must be asking for trouble, and that she was likely to have her throat slit. But Georgie said nothing, as by then, she was smitten. Georgie was now the girlfriend of a gangster. But having failed to live up to his reputation as a killer, the attack on the young girl in a dark lane who was riding a bicycle had come across not as callous and cruel, but as cowardly. That night, Ricky promised to make it up to her, and a lone cabbie would be in his sights. Thursday the 5th of October, late afternoon. Having sold off the girls' clothing coupons for £1, the twosome went to the cinema, and as they departed the Gaumont at roughly 10 p.m, Ricky said,
"We'll go and do another job."
"I understood he meant to go and steal some money from someone," Georgie said. Brazenly returning to Reading in the stolen truck, a little after midnight, they pulled up to the White Hart pub, which he had spied the night before. With the pub closed, but the staff cashing up, it was the perfect hit. A quick rush of adrenaline and a big score as he hightailed it out of there with the night's takings. For Ricky the gangster, the professional thief, and the ruthless killer, this little heist was surely chicken feed.
and the kind of crime which would make him worthy in the eyes of his girlfriend. Only as he sat in the truck, nervously shifting in his seat, his teeth gritted, the gun in his sweaty hand, and him geeing himself up for an armed robbery. As Georgie excitedly watched on, he suddenly had a change of heart and drove off. "Where are you going?" Georgie snapped. "Why are we driving away?" Ricky said he was certain that the caper was too dangerous.
"I saw them. They were watching me," he said.
Only Georgie had seen no one. The drive back to London was the longest they'd endured. The silence was painful. And with Georgie getting fed up with this little big man, who was all mouth and no trousers, the thrill was gone. Her man was weak, and Georgie was looking elsewhere. So it was as they approached Marble Arch that Ricky said Georgie had an idea.
"As we got there, she suggested we rob a cab."
And after so many failures, being keen to impress her, the killer of George Heath went hunting. For a short while, they prowled the West End in the truck, hunting for a lone cab.
"We saw one just off Park Lane,"
Georgie would state.
Ricky said,
"I'm going to follow it and take his money."
And with a six-wheeled, 2.5-ton US Army truck being a familiar sight in wartime Britain, they didn't stand out as they tailed the lone cabbie 4 miles northwest, up the Edgware Road, and all the way to Cricklewood. Ricky stated,
"The cab stopped for 10 minutes. I parked the truck about half a block back. The cab then turned around and I followed it."
Tailing this dark Ford saloon as it headed west, it didn't matter who the driver was. All that mattered was how much money he had and how impressed Georgie would be. Keeping his distance, Ricky held back until he found a lonely spot on the Kilburn High Road, where there were no cars nor houses, no passers-by nor policemen. As the truck roared past, from the left-hand driver's side window, with the cabin blackout, all he could make out was a lone driver smoking a cigarette, unaware of what was about to happen to him. And with the time being 2:10 a.m, it was then that Ricky struck.
"I passed the cab and turned in front of it, forcing it to stop."
With her eyes wide, Georgie watched excitedly, a gangster movie playing out right in front of her. As Ricky jumped down, stuck the gun in the window, and with the muzzle right in the driver's face, he demanded,
"I want your money. All of it."
The cabbie, 56-year-old John Strangeway, whimpered with fear.
"I don't have any money. I've just come out."
Which was the truth, as his cash box was bare. And as Ricky reached in to check, it was then that Ricky, who was driving a stolen army truck, holding a stolen army issue gun, wearing a stolen US Army officer's uniform, and was using the alias of Second Lieutenant Ricky Allen, got the shock of his life. In the dark of the back seat was sat a passenger, dressed in the US Army Air Force officer's uniform, Ricky was face to face with Lieutenant George McMillan Reeves, who had seen his face, who witnessed the robbery, and more importantly, had heard his very identifiable accent. A mix of Swedish, Boston. Fleeing as fast as he could, back in Hammersmith, he hid the truck in the Goldman Cinema car park. Ricky and Georgie hid out in her room. And following another failed robbery, Ricky was treated to a cold shoulder and a lengthy silence, as her so-called gangster had failed her again. Carl Holton, alias Ricky Allen, was positively identified at Willesden Green Police Station by the cabbie John Strangeway and his passenger, the US Army Lieutenant. Having gone AWOL from Reading, with no known civilian criminal record in Britain, the hard part would be to find Ricky, as he didn't have a home, he didn't have family here, and being seen as a bit of a loser, he was a habitual liar and a fantasist. Ricky claimed to be a gangster, who, according to Georgie, had broken into many pubs, jewelers, cafes, greengrocers and pawnbrokers. He had shot an American soldier. He'd killed a man and a woman in the West End. And he'd killed several people in Chicago with a gun. As he said, he had run with a mob. But there was no proof of this. Not a single shred. And although he had stolen uniforms, a gun, and a 2.5-ton truck, he wasn't a crazed gangster on a killing spree, but just a boy with a hatred of authority who was rebelling against his conscription. And although cold-hearted, what he wanted to find was love. Having failed as a clerk, a mechanic, a driver, a skating instructor, a husband, a father, and a soldier, Carl Holton liked being Ricky Allen, as much as he enjoyed pretending to be a gangster to impress a girl, as the truth of who he really was wasn't all that exciting. And even the killing for which he would be executed wasn't a cold-blooded murder, but as he said, an accident. What we've heard so far were Georgie's words. Her version, recorded when she was arrested for her part in a murder. Georgie claimed that she was innocent. An excited little girl, led into danger by the thrill of a wannabe gangster with a big gob and no brains. But who was the cold-blooded psychopath? Was he pressured by a desire to impress his girl? Or was she the true psychopath who goaded him? Part 3 of 3 of Cold-Blooded concludes next week.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Dun, dun, dun. There you go, folks. Part two. Hope you enjoyed that. Ooh, all the thrills and spills and excitement of a mystery caper. I quite enjoyed researching this one because there's a lot of mystery to it. A lot of dun, dun, dun. And bits that you read in the kind of... There's bits and pieces out there. There's even a crappy film that was made years ago about it. And it's just not particularly good. But it was just really nice to dive into this case and go through all the bits and pieces. Because there's so much to cover in this, and what I don't want to do, I did think to myself, do I do a fourth part of the episode and we can dive into everything? But I thought, because sometimes it's just nice to tell the story and then, you know, do this crappy bit. But I think what I learned with the Soho Strangler is when we did Strangler Week and I'm able to go through all the details, and people seem to really rate that people seem to like that, which I liked. So what I'm going to do is that I think there's a lot of bits and pieces. What I want to do is go through all of the statements in its entirety for you so you can hear what people are saying. So what I'll do is I'll do all of Carl's statements, so Ricky as he's known, and all of Georgie's statements, or Elizabeth as she's known. So we'll do them all separately, and then you can listen to them in their entirety and kind of get an idea of what you think about them. But next week is the concluding part, as mentioned in the episode. So there we go. Oh, what time is it? Slightly later today, 2:22. Oh, you needed to know that, didn't you? 2:22. When I finish this, I think I'm going to go into the near town, go to the coffee shop, charge up my stuff. I don't think I've got time to go up to the coffee shop up the road. Or do I? Would I be able to make it? Would I have enough time to charge up my laptop there? I don't know. Maybe I'll go into town to get... I've got to get some food anyway. This is boring, isn't it? Lovely day outside. I've been trapped indoors finishing writing this and recording this. I can see some blue sky. It looks nice. Haven't been outside yet. I was about to say there's no planes, but we just had two big planes go over for no reason. I think they were private jets. I think it was those... There's a private airport not too far away from here, and it's... there's no real customs there, so you can come in and out. It's probably just drug dealers. Don't worry about that, just drug dealers. There was a coot outside having a bit of a shout, a bit of a go, but he's gone quiet. And there's no kids, which is great. Yesterday I was having some fun recording, because I wrote this episode, wrote the last episode, then recorded it, but didn't edit it, and then I started recording this one. It was kind of useful, because I worked out how I wanted to edit the next episode. These episodes. And with the disposal of the body in the ditch, I thought, oh, I could really do with some nice sounds of walking in a kind of a boggy scape. And on my way up to the other coffee shop up there, it's been raining for days, and it is really, really boggy. So I've recorded some really lovely sounds of kind of splashing in water, but then going through kind of thick mud and then leaves and that. So that's going to appear in here as well. That's what I do, is I record an episode and then I think about sounds and then I go off and record the sounds. So there you go. It's all a lot of work, but it's worth it. I might have a little cake later on. I might treat myself. I think I need one. It's been a good week, but an odd one. Odd one. My eye is playing up again. Really annoying. It's flared up. It's gone all red and horrible and weepy. And so I've literally just messaged my eye specialist to see whether I have to go back into hospital. Oh, joy. I had 10 whole days of good vision, and now I've gone backwards. Oh, bloody biology, eh? What else is going on? Oh, thank you to new Patreon subscribers. So thank you to Adam Robson and Rosie Carpenter. So thank you, Adam, and thank you, Rosie. Thank you for becoming Patreon subscribers. I hope you're enjoying all the goodies that are out there. Lots of goodies that I don't share anywhere else. Episodes of Walk With Me, everyone can listen to, depending on your tier. Exclusive videos, all the crime scene photos go on there. You get the e-script, the unedited version that's in there. And sometimes I post some secret little things on there as well. So lots of goodies to enjoy. And early episodes of Murder Mile as well, if you want to get it like 3 days earlier than everyone else. I've already taken off your hat. If you're wondering, I have taken off your hat. Your hat is off. I've got prepped a tea for myself, but I just can't be arsed. I don't think I want a tea. Let's just dive into shit. Not shit. Let's just dive into stuff. Stuff and things. So we'll do some quiz questions, and then we'll dive into some extra stuff about Carl and all that. There's so much in this case to cover. There really is. So I don't know how much I'll get into episode 3, but there's... I'll pack in as much as I can. There's not enough to do an episode 4 because there's not enough kind of... You need kind of highlight bits and you need to tell a story. And if you have an episode where nothing's happening, it kind of ruins the story. So that's why I'll do the Strangler Week type ideas. I think I'll call it like Cold-Blooded Extra or something. I don't know. I'll work it out. So let's do some quiz questions. The answers will be at the end of the episode. So let's do this. Oh, I'm going to put on my hat now, because as a man with a baldy bonce, it's pretty cold. So I'm sitting in the boat. I had the fire on for a day, but because the heat caused my eye to swell up, I'm sitting here in the cold with my pyjamas on and then some clothes on top and then some gloves and now a hat and a blanket and a hot water bottle. So there we go. I hope my eye gets a bit better. Otherwise, I will be spending winter sitting here in the cold by myself. Oh, joy. Obviously, I'll be kept warm because Eva will keep me warm by ordering me around as she does. She can't hear that at the moment. She's spark out. She's unconscious as always. Right, let's do the quiz questions. Question number one. What was the name of the fireman who found George's body? Question number two, why was George supposed to pick up Violet, his girlfriend, at 8 a.m? Question number three, what was George meant to... I've run out of steam and I can't read. I am using one eye again. Question number three, why was George meant to see Harry Hawkins at 9 a.m? Question number four, name one of the items left in George's pocket. So obviously the killers took all of stuff they wanted out of his pocket, but what was left in his pocket? I named eight things. Name one of them. Question number five. What was the name of the witness who heard the stolen car revving when George's body was dumped? Question six. What was found in George... Oh, sorry. Who found George's wallet? Oh, I just can't read this anymore. Question number seven, where was Ricky... fuck's sake. Question seven, where was Carl, alias Ricky, born? So it's not even a difficult sentence. And question number eight, what military operation was he due to take part in but didn't? So let's dive into some details. Name was Carl Gustav Holten. He was a private, so not a second lieutenant at all. So I got burpees. He was in the 2nd Battalion Serving Company in the 501st Infantry Regiment, which at that point was part of the 101st. He's 22 years old. I'm not going to say that bit because that's a quiz question. He entered the US on the 1st of December 1923 when he was aged one. His mother's name was Sinya, and she was a personal maid to a lady in Boston. They were so most of his life was spent in Boston, Massachusetts. But his mother was Swedish, his father was Swedish. So he had, as mentioned in the episode, he had one of those kind of weird accents where it's kind of a bit of both. We've all got kind of odd accents when you piece it together. He stated to a prison doctor that his father was a man of a violent temper and that his parents had separated for 17 years. So it was roughly when he was around 5 years old that his parents separated. He attended the Farm and Trade School in Boston. He married, I didn't mention it much in the episode, he married a lady called Rita and they had one daughter. She remained in Boston. As mentioned in the episode, he'd
he had several jobs. He couldn't really find his place. He was inducted into the US Army on the 24th of May, 1943. Didn't mention this in the episode as well, but I think this could be part of his anger as well. 17th of October, 1943, he submitted an application for naturalization to be an American citizen. But it didn't seem to go through, and we don't know why. One thing does suggest that the paperwork was never completed. Another was that it was rejected, so we don't know. So even though, yeah, he wasn't born in America, but he was trying to become an American citizen but couldn't. He was inducted into the US Army. Obviously, this was just after the bombing of Pearl Harbor in December 1941. He arrived in the UK as an army truck driver in January 1944. As mentioned in the episode, he knows how to drive a truck, and that's because that's what he does, and hence he stole one. Don't forget in the story that because these are US Army trucks, these are left-hand drive. Do you know, they're on the wrong side of the road there, left-hand drive. So when I mention driving seat, I try and put in there left and right-hand drive, but if it's driver, it's left-hand side. If it's passenger, it's right-hand side. So just think of it as the wrong way. There you go. He came over here January 1944. He didn't know, same with all the other soldiers, he didn't know why he was here. But later in June, he would find out that he was meant to be part of the D-Day invasion of Europe. We don't really seem to know why. Why he wasn't part of the invasion force, because everybody else seemed to be. So we don't know. He first absented on the 17th of July 1944. He was arrested on the 12th of August 1944. So basically he absconded from the prison camp. Well, for him it probably felt like it. Absconded from his army base. He was meant to have a court-martial. He was arrested. They managed to get him back. He was confined on the 17th of August. And then the next day, which was meant to be his court-martial, he fled. So from the 17th of August onwards, he's not on the base. He's kind of being hunted down. Let's not forget that during this time as well, you've got World War II. When World War II started, I think I mentioned this in the Blackout Ripper episodes, they cleared out most of the prisons of anyone who was kind of had a sentence of less than 3 months, because they knew that they were going to have to fill it up with, you know, spies and people like that, traitors. But also it was going to be used for people who were going AWOL. They knew there was going to be a lot of that going about, because people were being conscripted as opposed to voluntarily going, yeah, I will give my life and fight for my country and probably die on a beach bleeding somewhere. He stole a gun. It was while he was there. It was a 48 Colt Remington Rand, or an automatic. It was marked United States property. He'd stolen it from Staff Sergeant Irving Sherman. We got the serial number there. There were 7 rounds of 45 caliber bullets when it was later handed into the police, and it was an American, a US Army service issue. We'll probably get into this. We'll get into this into the next part of the episode. But Robert Churchill, who we mentioned in there, was the Met Police gun specialist. He said it was in good working order and was not liable for an accidental discharge. Ooh, if only we were all like that. He'd stolen a uniform. We don't know whether he'd stolen it from someone's quarters or whether when he stole the truck, it was in the truck. That is a liability. That is a possibility. But he stole it in the cloak. He hid it in the cloakroom in what is known as a B4 bag. So that's one of those over the shoulder canvas things that the guys carry. And that he hid it in the cloakroom at the Hammersmith Metropolitan Tube Station. And he stole the truck. He says in Reading on the 28th or the 29th of September. So he'd had it for about 10 days. So it's amazing that, given the fact that the American forces were missing a truck, that they weren't really searching for it that hard, given the fact that it's quite easy to spot. And you'd be looking for the license plate, really, wouldn't you? But there we go. As mentioned in the episode, Ricky the Gangster, he bragged about... he bragged to Georgie about all the things he'd stolen, all the places. He said, Wednesday last, he broke into a jeweller's on King Street, a gown shop in called Richardson's on King Street. We don't quite know why he broke into a gown shop. Maybe he wanted to get a dress for himself. A cafe in Shepherd's Bush, a greengrocer's and a pawnbroker's. He'd broken into several pubs in Reading, apparently, but as we've already seen in this episode, he doesn't seem to be that confident in the breaking into pubs or doing armed robberies, but there we go. And apparently he said he shot an American soldier, this is George's words, whom I think he said he drowned, which is odd. He shot an American soldier and then he drowned him. Was it one or both? Or we don't know. Another thing he said was that he killed a man and a woman with a gun in the West End, and that he hung around with a gang in Chicago, even though he's from Boston. But of course, it sounds more exciting, doesn't it? If you say Chicago gang, don't forget this is kind of an era where you have all the kind of the Jimmy Cagney films on the cinema, and this is what George is going to see, and probably what Carl's seeing as well. And they're very excited about this, and they want to be seen as something exciting. The girl who he knocked over, he didn't really knock her over. He pushed her off her bike and then stole her handbag, and possibly was trying to kill. Now, what was interesting is she never went to the police about this, and the people whose house she was found outside of, they don't seem to have gone to the police either. So we don't know whether she just didn't come forward and they didn't come forward. Georgie and Carl don't seem to say very much about this. They're quite vague in their details about this, although interviewed separately, they did seem to come up with similar details. But it could have been bullshit. It could have been something they made up. We don't know. I think this is part of the thing that I'll probably get into for next week, is that what I did with this episode is I told you pretty much. So part one was all George's story, because I really wanted it to be the victim story. And then part two, we go, right, the psychopath. So we focus on the killer. And what I did with part one was I really focused on Carl being the killer, and because he's the one with the gun and he's the one making the decisions and all that. So I want you to go, oh, dark and sinister man. In part one, we don't know his name, and, you know, it's just the soldier, the man, it's things like that. But when we get to part two, we start learning about him, and I've already put it in your head that he's a gangster and a psychopath, cold-blooded, all these horrible words. But by the time you get here and you start learning about him, you start realising that it starts becoming quite ineffective. He's a bit useless. He can't really do a lot. And I think that's it. Maybe with this story is maybe this theft didn't happen. We really don't know much about it. We don't know who the girl's name was. I really did search. There's nothing in the police files, nothing in the press statements. There's nothing there at all. So I don't think I'm going to read out too much of this, because we will be going through. I'll read a little bit. We will be going through all of the story later on. No, actually, I won't. Let's see what's ahead. I changed my mind. I'll just read a little bit of Elizabeth's. I've written it down as EJ. This is Georgina, but don't forget her real name is Elizabeth Jones. When we got to Reading, he drove around town and we started back towards London at about 2 a.m. I think we got on the road back, as far as I can say, near Maidenhead, but I know it was on the London Bath Road. We passed a girl on a bicycle going in the same direction. The reason I'm reading this is because we used a lot of it in the episode. We drove on for about 5 minutes and he pulled up along the side of the road. He got out and waited for the girl on the bicycle to come along. I sat in the truck. When the girl came alongside the truck, I saw him push her off her bicycle. Ooh, what a brave boy. When it was still going and she fell off into the road. She screamed, "Don't touch me." And as it was a clear night, I saw him pick something up and the girl ran off. That would have been the purse. Ricky climbed back into the truck and I drove off. It was a left-hand drive and during the night he'd taught me to drive. As we were driving along at fast speed, Ricky drew my attention to the girl who was crouching in the shrubbery at the side of the road. I think it was the front garden of a house. As we were going along, Ricky looked through the girl's handbag. When we were driving along, Ricky climbed over me and took over the wheel and asked me to look through the bag. I found a book. half her clothing coupons, about 9 shillings, some letters, some photographs, some sanitary towels, a face flannel, some soap and a face towel. So the girl was clearly coming back from work or a night out. We're not too sure. As mentioned, we don't know anything about the girl at all. The coupons themselves. So Carl ended up selling the coupons to Len Bexley, who we met at the start of the episode, and we also met at the end of the first episode as well, who is a friend of George's daughter. Len's daughter used to work with Georgia. It's annoying here because he keeps calling her Georgina and it's not, it's Georgia, even though technically neither is right nor wrong because it's Elizabeth. So those clothing coupons were sold to Len Bexley for about £1. And that's all they really had. Don't forget, they really didn't have a lot from her. The failed robbery, we know it was somewhere in Sunning, which is just outside Reading. We don't know exactly where the pub was. It was the White Hart. I did do a search before, but I couldn't find it. It's not there anymore, and I couldn't find out where it was. It doesn't matter anyway. It's not really important to the story. They went to the cinema. We don't know what film they went to see. They finished at about 10 o'clock. We know that they went back to the little cafe that they went to before and had some food. We know there was an air raid siren at that point because she says the siren sounded. And he said to her, "We'll go and do another job." She said, "I understood that meant to go and steal some money from someone." Now, obviously, what we're getting is all of her story first. So, because this is the way it was presented to the police as well. It's kind of, you'll find out in part three, kind of he was arrested first. He did a kind of a no comment and denied most of it. But when they arrested her, she started talking and that really scuppered him. What have we got? The tailing of the cab. It was a deliberate bit of deception on my behalf because I wanted you to think, oh, we're going to go back to the cab. This is how they find him. They're tailing him and then they pretend to be customers, but it's not. It's a different cab. But this is the whole point, is that it's all this failure that's going through. Like, he's saying to her about, oh, I'm a big man, I'm a gangster, I've robbed all these places, I've killed lots of people, I used to run with a gang, oh, look at me, I'm great. But when you look at it, like, he struggles to even rob, like, a lone girl on a bicycle riding down a dark alley who's by herself. He won't go in and rob in, like, a pub, which is closing up. You know, he's quite cowardly. He's not the gangster that he's professing to be. And now, you know, he can talk the talk, but when it comes to walking the walk, he can't do it. He's struggling. You know, it's not really who he is, and that's starting to come out. And he's realizing that she's just not interested anymore. She's kind of drifting away. So he kind of has to do something. So according to him, she says, she suggests that we rob a cab. So that's what they do. They find a lone cab. They go north. Hammersmith is west. It's probably about 6 or 7 miles west and slightly south. Whereas Cricklewood from Marble Arch is 4.2 miles north, northwest-ish, more north than west. That's not really important, is it? Who cares? But that's the kind of the idea. That's what I wanted to do with this episode, was to make you go, oh, you're going to catch up with George and then, you know, there's going to be something going on. But it wasn't. It was an entirely different cabbie. As mentioned, it was roughly around 2:10 a.m. on Friday the 6th of October 1944. So if you were clever, you would have noticed that we were 24 hours before the murder of George. I was being quite slightly deceitful with the times. I did tell you what day it was, but I just didn't reiterate that it was 24 hours until the end, 24 hours before George was dead. George was fine at this point. He was out doing his job. The cabbie was George Strangeway, 56, of North Street in Luton. He was driving his cab along the high road in Kilburn. In the back seat was Lieutenant George McMillan Reeves of the US Army Air Force. He was an officer. He was riding as a passenger. Don't forget, as mentioned in the episode, because it's blackout, not only do your headlights have to be, they're like little tiny slits. So you can use it to guide your way along the road, but it doesn't illuminate the road. That's the whole point of the the blackout, but also you can't have like your interior light in your car on. You can't switch it on because that will illuminate your car. They even during World War II, they would say, if you're going to light your cigarette, you've got to cover your hand to light your cigarette because they don't want anything illuminating your face, which can illuminate the street, you know, and identify bombers to where big parts of the city are. So everyone is being really cautious. Therefore, even in the back of the cab, some of the backs of the cabs as well, I know George's did, it had blackout screens, so he could see out of his front window and his side window, but the passenger side windows at the back and the rear screen were covered over with a blackout cloth, so therefore it kind of shielded any kind of light that may emanate from there. Yeah, we don't know the exact location of where on the Kilburn High Road this took place. It wasn't registered in the police files, and obviously the press don't record anything properly anyway, so there's just no chance of finding it there. But I think that is it. I think that's all I want to tell you about that one, because obviously part three, we're going to go through a lot. I can tell you more at the end of Extra Mile. That's the problem with these multi-parts, is that there's only so much I can tell you, but then we'll do the extra things, and yeah, you can just listen to those when you need to, and I'll add in all the extra details that I couldn't add anywhere else. Also, I've got all of the original witness statements, so I might just read those verbatim, I think, because they might be quite nice. Okay, let's do some quiz questions, and then I can toddle off to the coffee shop. It's 2:46. It'll take me 25 minutes to get there. That's 3:30. That means all the little bastards will have left school. Ah, shit. Let's hope I can get a coffee shop. A plug socket, that's what I need. Right, let's do this. Ooh, my eye hurts. Right, questions. Let's do the answers. Come on, brain, get into gear. Question number one. What was the name of the fireman who found George's body? It was Robert Balding. Question number two. Why was George supposed to pick up Violet at 8 a.m? He was taking her and some pals to Ascot Races. Question number three. Why was George meant to see Harry Hawkins at 9 a.m? He was dropping the car back. Question number four. Name one of the items left in George's pocket by the killers. Okay, so if you got any one of these, you get a point. So it was two hankies, a broken comb, a latch key, five cigarettes, a cinema ticket, a pocket knife, a rubber, not that kind, and a vial of three pills. We don't know what the pills were, but don't forget, he'd spent a while in a psychiatric hospital, so it could have been for that. Question number five, what was the name of the witness who heard the stolen car revving when George's body was dumped? It was Reginald Turney. Question number six. Who found the wallet? It was John Anthony Jones, who was an electrician's apprentice. Question number seven. Where was Carl, alias Ricky, born? In Stockholm, in Sweden.
Sweden.
Question number eight. What that was a really poor impression.
Sweden.
Question number eight. What military operation was he due to take part in, but didn't? It was the bloody invasion of Normandy, codenamed Operation Overlord, on the 6th of June, 1944. So there you go, folks, that's it. Hope you enjoyed that. That was part two of Cold Blooded. Next week is part three, the final part, the concluding part of Cold Blooded. We'll do the little, I'll put out the little extras immediately afterwards as well, so you can enjoy that. And then you can just dip straight into those, and then hopefully I'm hoping to do a little Christmas episode. I was going to do some little mini parters, but I've got a lot of projects on. I don't know how much time I've got, so that doesn't mean I'm going to die. Hopefully I'm not going to die, but you know, things. So, but I'll try my best anyway. Hope you're all having a good week. Hope you're all staying safe. Thank you for continuing to listen to Murder Mile. It's very much appreciated. Have yourself a good week. Stay safe and be good. Lots of love.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.